felt like I was playing an ad there, but I'm not playing an ad. Welcome to Wagon Wheel. I'm not sure exactly what happened there. I'm Jared Kimber. This is the podcast where we answer your questions on cricket. The best way, of course, is to get them in earlier via Patreon, a Good Areas podcast. You can find us over there on Patreon and you can support us and find the right tier and you can ask a question every week. You can ask two questions every week. Separate to that, you can also, if you're on the live, you can go in with a super chat, which we're more than happy to accept any of those as well. But let's start with the Patreon questions from Adityan, who says, love the episode on swing with Aaron. When somebody shares some surprising info after doing tons of research, I assume there are quite a few surprises in that episode. How do you go about updating your prior beliefs? Do you try and confirm it yourself or do you talk to other people? In this case, who else would you even talk to? Is there anyone else who would have done this good research before? So I've read some stuff before. And, you know, so I think it has to, I already had a fairly good idea. I was pretty sure that Aaron had some information that I didn't have. And so, again, it wasn't as if this completely changed my worldview. I think there is a conflation a little bit. And I think Aaron's right here between players thinking this thing happens because I think there's more reverse swing in the IPL this year, in part because players believe the saliva thing. Doesn't necessarily mean that saliva plays a part, but the players believe it does. So they're trying to get more reverse. And it's exactly the same with cloud cover, right? So those things I've always had a bit of an understanding of. I still think we need to see more testing in live situations. And everything else. But that is where Aaron is going with his stuff as well. But yeah, it's up to me to get as much information as I can. My opinions have probably changed thousands of times, right? On many different things. That's part of the gig. And if you want to be, you know, I wouldn't say I grew up, but I came into an industry where there are a lot of journalists who like their decision was their decision and that nothing could change it. I don't see the point in that. I've been wrong thousands of times before and I'll be wrong again. My job is to get as much information as possible and try and come with the best information I have. And the cloud thing, if you've been following me, you know that clouds and swing, I've always doubted a little bit just because I grew up in Melbourne and there wasn't always clouds and the ball used to swing around corners, right? Good wrist position and a good quality ball always seemed to make a lot more sense to me than cloud cover did. So yeah, that's kind of what you're doing. But yeah, I'm talking to players. I've got a couple of friends who I think are very smart, some that have science backgrounds, some that don't have science backgrounds, but some that understand, you know, these sorts of advanced things. And yeah, I definitely think that there's, it's up to me to get as much information as possible. Nadika says, where does Michael Holding rank in the list of the greatest West Indian fast bowlers? Well, I don't even have a list of the greatest fast bowlers at the moment. So we're a long way away from that right now. I think I have Garner, Ambrose, and Mount Marshall ahead of him. And he's at the top list of that next group, which is probably what? Roberts, himself, Walsh, Hall. And he might be, him and Hall for the next up there. But yeah, you know, he'd be. There's probably, I'm trying to think, which countries would he be the number one seam bowler for? Sri Lanka? Yeah, there probably aren't that many others, are there? But yeah, he'd probably be top three for quite a few countries. But West Indies had a few of them. Lemon says, Zimbabwe beat Bangladesh. Who beat Pakistan? Who beat England? Does Zimbabwe have a chance against England? I don't know if you saw the video we did, Lemon, not that long ago of the of that pattern from last year. 2024 was crazy. So well done to Zimbabwe for also making it even more confusing. Do they have a chance? No. Like, as in, they're going to start the game at what, 8-1, I would assume? I would have to, depending on the draw and everything else, maybe even further than that. They have some chances of doing some damage to England because they have seamers who can take wickets in clumps, especially early on. There's no reason why England can't be 40-4 in this test match. They have the ability to do that. They've done it now over a consistent enough period. I'm backing them to be able to do that. So, yes. Do they have enough to win the game? Probably not, right? But I think they can make it messy and icky and murky at times. Person says, two early predictions on Vaibhav Sarangi's career next 5 years. It's a fascinating question. This isn't the tough bit for him. The same way it wasn't for, I don't know, Renshaw or Fraser McGurk or I'm trying to think of some other players who came in really, really young. It's usually, I mean, they call it in American sports, don't they? Second year blues. That's when everyone starts to work you out. That's the tough bit. And it's really tough if you're an advanced child prodigy because you've never been worked out before. He's never failed, right? He just hasn't. You can't play first class cricket at that young and have failed. You have to, everything has to go almost perfectly for you. So what happens when he goes through five or six games where he doesn't make runs? What happens when bowlers work out a line or a length or a strategy against him that works, or a field setting or whatever that may be? Things are going to change really quickly. That's where being a professional matters. And, you know, it's what me and Robbie were talking about. So I don't know. I just don't want to keep heaping pressure on him. He's a brilliant ball striker. He's very confident at the moment. I think in the next 5 years, we see a dip in his confidence and we see him hopefully become a professional. And if he can become a professional at a young age in a way that, say, Sachin did, someone else, maybe someone like Javed Miendad did, that sort of mindset of, okay, I didn't just start young. Like, I now actually need to work out the game. Whereas we've seen other players start young and just never deal with that side of it. Ashraf Hall is a perfect example of that. Ashraf Hall was a really talented player as a teenager, but he never dealt with the professional side of cricket. And he never rounded out his game the way he had to. Matt Renshaw, it's taken him for years to come back, right? You know, and he's still nowhere near. So there's a long way to go. But I mean, any teenager with that level of talent at that age, you should be predicting a high ceiling for. But we did this on one of the podcasts, I think, with me and Rob Barron, where I went through all the players in international cricket with more than 1,000 runs as teenagers. There's a lot more busts than you would expect. It's not automatic. Rudra says, how did you rate Abu Necham as a bowler? I remember thinking he was a decent sharp seamer who helped them win their first title and also Champions League, but then completely fell off. Do you know what? I have not thought of that name in so long that like what is he? He's like less than MS Dhoni. He's only 36 now. When did he play his last IPL game? 2015. Look, he swung the ball both ways. I never felt he was completely accurate. He reminds me, actually, I just want to see if I can find his bowling figures here. He never took more than 5 wickets in a season, which is a little bit surprising to me. He just reminded me of one of those bowlers who wasn't quite at that level, but had some skills and probably needed to develop and become slightly more accurate, slightly faster, maybe a great slow ball or something. He only needed one other development, and I think he's probably an IPL level player. I think you see that a lot. Especially with white ball bowlers now, it's very hard to be having one skill unless that one skill is absolutely elite. So, you know, David Willey, right, is a really good example of that. Of David Willey, even if he couldn't bat at all, probably would have still done pretty well and gotten into a lot of teams based on the fact that his one bowling skill, he was really good at swinging the ball early on. If you're not at that level, it's really hard to maintain a professional career. Do you think Venkatesh Iyer is overrated by KKR? I find Venky a fascinating cricketer, I'll be honest. And I love late bloomers. But that first season, when everyone went wild for him, I didn't think it was that good. He has since then. Here's the things I like about him as a player. He completely plays for the moment and the team in a way that is far rarer in cricket than you would expect. Like, I really don't think that many batters do this, right? And so because of that, there are sometimes when he has mass failures in a row because he's come in situations where they're behind the rate, they're chasing a big total, whatever, and he would just go for it. He's very boom or bust. He's very 5 or 50. And so there's huge variance in his career. But if you look at the last 2 years, he averaged 28 with a strike rate of 145 and then 46 with a strike rate of 158. That's 2 really good years in a row, but after 2 pretty poor years. So he's 30 now, right? You have a situation there where it's hard to know what the real Venky is. He struggled a little bit this year. He's obviously slightly overpaid, but a lot of those batters were overpaid just because of the way that the mega auction came out, right? There was, 5 of them. Everyone was bidding for like 2 of them. Other than Ishan Kishan, everyone got like a big bump in wage, right? You know, and got up to a ridiculous amount. I think they also thought of him as a leader. Maybe that one hasn't quite panned out. I like Venky because he legitimately can bat 6 positions, right? Or 5 positions. I love the fact he bats for the team, but he's not like the most skillful player in the world. But geez, he tries hard. So I'm a big fan. Is he overrated? He was overpaid. I don't know if that means he's overrated. Those two things. I think this is the problem with the mega auction and the auctions in general, is that we focus on the amount. Sometimes two teams just have the similar type hole and they're trying to fix it and players end up getting paid too much. Neil Bose says, if he didn't turn out for Netherlands, do you think Ryan Tendoskar could have made it with South Africa or even England, given his long Essex stint? So I know Tendo a little bit, and we've talked about this before. He left because he didn't really think he was close. So I'm going to go with him, and I'm going to go with Grant Elliott. I think if Neil Wagner stays, he probably plays. I don't think Devin Conway might have if he managed to find Fawn again in South Africa. But I don't think that Grant Elliott or Ryan Tentescato would have, just because their bowling was probably not that useful in a country that has found lots of seam bowling all-rounders. And I don't think that the kind of batting that they had would have ever been seen as a high enough skill. Weirdly, if Tendo was a spinner or Grant Elliott was a spinner, I actually think then that changes things. Tendo would have been a really good player for England. His bowling might not have translated as much internationally. I don't actually know what his record is. I think he's one of those players who it would have been interesting. I don't think I've ever really had this conversation with anyone about him. Why can I not find his name? Probably because I put a Q in it. I just want to have a look at his bowling record overall. So in first class cricket, yeah, it's about a wicket a game. Slightly better when he's bowling in associate cricket. Very suited to associate level cricket. Less than a wicket a game in white ball cricket and didn't bowl much in T20. I think he could play for England. Yeah, he would have gone up in a period where they actually had a pretty good team. So maybe he struggles to squeeze himself in. But I think he would have played limited overs cricket for England. Definitely. He was a fantastic player. He's very, very a humble person as well. He really was a fantastic cricketer. Ben says, why don't England or Australia make an agreement with a Sri Lankan first class setup and basically have a full-time spin? Oh, Ben, are you talking my language? I wrote about this in 2008. In 2010, some Cricket Australia person found me and wanted to talk to me about it. Yes, yes. And it's not just about a spin bowling camp. Yes, it would help your spinners. Yes, it helps your batting against spin. You also send your paces over. You need your paces to understand how to bowl in Asian conditions. I don't understand why this never happened. It's a real mistake of major cricket boards. And I would say the same with India. Why doesn't India have a permanent camp in the West Indies or South Africa as well? They want to do deals with each other, these major boards. And it's like, this is the deal to do. Like, this is what I would be 100% involved, especially with Australia's relationship with Sri Lanka, right? Coaches and, half the Sri Lankan team retires to Melbourne, right? Like, I've never understood this. I think it's probably gone now because I think international cricket has changed. But yeah, this is what I would have done. So I've heard so much nonsense from, especially from Australian cricket, about how they're going to get good in Asia, when the most obvious thing has always been, in your off season, can you have your players living in Sri Lanka for 3 months? It's not as expensive, and you can offset it. You're also helping Sri Lanka, so maybe the Sri Lankan government will put something in. You can have a center of excellence there, brain share, skill share, preparation, everything. It's just, yeah, I've never understood that one, Ben. For me, that was an absolute no-brainer. Okay, let's have a quick break here on the Wagon Wheel, and we'll be back very shortly for more wagons and more wheels. Sometimes you just need to take the slips out and bowl defensively. And you also need to be careful with your computer's defense as well. If you need a VPN, go Nord. NordVPN.com/Kimber to get a 2-year contract with a discount, plus 4 extra months and gifts in some markets. It's completely risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. The link is in the show notes. So put in some dot balls and turn them into maidens via NordVPN.com/Kimber. Welcome back to Good Areas Live, the Wagon Wheel podcast. Lemon says, what are your thoughts on the current grade cricketer video situation? It sounds counterintuitive to disincentivize coverage as it would help grow the league. Yes. It's not the first time that a cricket board has been short-sighted when it comes to coverage. They want everyone to basically pay for this digital package that I think they're charging. Well, I would assume they're charging some of the bigger publications like newspapers, Cricket Info, Cricket Buzz. And I don't know that 100%, but I'm just assuming. That is my guess. You're not ever going to make that much money off it. And also, as you've said, don't you just want everyone to talk about cricket? I don't see how this helps them. There must be something that I'm not seeing. Like, I understand the idea of it. Like, we've seen this with the NFL and the Super Bowl before. So it's not as if the BCCI and the IPL have invented this whole thing of you can't use the word IPL or you can't use the team names or anything. It was a big thing a few years ago when we started our YouTube channel. We didn't use the names, and then it just seemed to disappear. So we started using them again. I do understand it from a certain point of like, we have made this brand, you have not paid anything to this brand, you're going to make money. But that's always been the agreement between the media and the leagues, right? And they want to change that, and they're not the only ones who want to change that. So, look, I think it is a fascinating one. I don't see how they're ever going to make enough money off this that it's worth their time to police it. And are they just going to police, is Great Cricket big enough, but maybe other major, like there are other podcasts out there, you know, that are doing this. There are other YouTube channels that are far bigger than Great Cricket that are using these names that are not paying for them, right? So why are they just policing this one channel? So for me, from the outside, it certainly feels like a very weird situation. The one thing that cricket has always had trouble with is this feeling of ownership, right? It's always been an issue with the way that cricket has been governed. And it's really sad to see what is the biggest league in the world, which doesn't need to worry about any of this sort of stuff, worrying about this kind of stuff. There's so much more that they could be interested in and talking about. And I actually think they should be helping. Like, the ICC is not a particularly well-run organization. We can all say World Cup, right? Cricket World Cup is also trademarked, right? On top of that, look at what the ICC did. They got John Boy involved, a creator who, let's be fair, had broken copyright restrictions before, involved in their commentary. That's the way forward. The Great Cricketer are massively popular. It just feels to me like a miscalculation, but these boards are not particularly well run. And who knows, it could have been one person who was upset at it. It always reminds me of a conversation that Lalit Modi had with Sambit Bale from Cricket Info, where I think it was before Sambit even ran Cricket Info, but Sambit used to run a cricket magazine in India, and on the front page was Rahul Dravid in his India cap. And Lalit Modi was going, "You can't use that. We own that. That's our logo. Sambit was like, "Huh? What?" And it's like, do you want the magazine to pay to use the Indian cricket logo? And that's the way that Lalit Modi was thinking. But also, what's the alternative? That Rahul Dravid does the photo shoot without the hat. How does that help Indian cricket? And at the moment, the BCCI or the IPL don't have to worry about that. They're getting so many eyeballs. But the media still isn't great. I actually think that the BCCI has made a huge problem in not propping up the media to make it better. The media around the IPL is still really, really poor. There aren't beat writers, right? There aren't podcast networks. There aren't great shows. There's a lot of just nonsense and fluff. I don't know. If it was me, I'd be more worried about that. But we have different thoughts on these things. It's not the first time I'm going to think differently than a cricket board about something like this. Person says, thoughts on New Zealand, are cricket investing in an MLC franchise? I've said before, I think this teams should be thinking about this more often. I like the idea of it. I love the sort of franchise cricket's going to be more important in the future. If you can get involved with a franchise now, I think you're much better. I think Lords made a mistake not buying an IPL team back in the day. And so now, I like this. I reckon this is the second or third time New Zealand's tried to break into America one way or another. This is probably the most solid plan I've seen so far. Roger says, suppose that in 2011, after a disappointing debut series in the West Indies, India decide that Kohli won't be good enough for Tess. If India doesn't pick him a test any point since, what happens to the team? How different does it look, and how much worse would it be? And can you answer the same question if there was a Kohli but no Ashwin? I think there is a fallacy is the wrong word. I think there is this thought that like Kohli changed everything within Indian cricket because of his captaincy, because of his leadership, and because of his aggression. I think he was a much better bowler, at least in part, much better captain, at least in part, because he had bowlers. Two of the best spinners in the world, and then he had a bunch of seamers. MS Dhoni would have killed for that lineup, right? And he didn't have that. So I still think they would have that great bowling lineup. Maybe Kohli captains them differently than someone else would have. Like, I think that's fair. Might have captained them worse, right? They might have had another, maybe Rahane would have been a tactical genius and would have got even more out of them, right? But probably they would have been worse. They wouldn't have had Virat Kohli, the batter, who had one of the best peaks of all time. So the team would be a lot worse because they didn't have the batting. But I'm not sure if the leadership thing is as much. Professionalism is interesting, though. That's one thing that he was just an uber professional at a time where I don't think that was really at the forefront of Indian cricket. So I think that has certainly changed things. Yeah, as far as Ashwin, I wonder if they wouldn't have had the same kind of wickets at home if it wasn't for Ashwin. Would that be the major difference there? Aditya said, you have often said. There's a lot of said there. You have often said that Sanon Gavaskar might be the greatest player of spin in history. Keeping that in mind, how do you think he would have gone against Warn and Murali? Well, we know that Brian Lara handled Warn and Murali quite well. I think great players of spin actually handled Warn and Murali pretty well. The problem is that if you weren't a great player of spin and you couldn't use your feet, you got really stuck against both those guys. I don't think you could have been a Ken Barrington or Len Hutton. I'm trying to think of other great players who were players of spin who didn't move their feet all that much. I think you would have struggled if you were that, whereas Gavaskar could do that and would do that. And he was very quick. And I think I'm right in saying that he was one of those players who played spin waiting for the ball to go up above the eye line. If that's the case, then he would have been okay against Warner Murali. So I would have Lara on a very similar level to Gavaskar, not quite as high. And he was a great player against them. So I don't see why he wouldn't have handled them as well. I'm trying to think if there's anything in his technique that might have given him an issue with Warn specifically. I don't think so. Ben says, I don't read especially well, so I've pre-ordered the audiobook on Audible. How did you find recording it? Is it something you've done before or totally new? It was the first time I've ever done an audiobook. He's, of course, talking about The Art of Batting, available 8 May. First audiobook I've ever done. I actually tried it once with one of my old books, and it was just so hard to record on your own, and you couldn't tell if you were reading it right. And I was reading it quickly, then slow. So I gave up after about 3 chapters. This is the first one that I read all the way through and finished and did professionally with a producer and everything. It's an intense couple of days. I did 3.5 days on it. I think most people do 4.5 to 5 days. Luckily I spend a lot of my time reading, and I could do it from home and everything. But yeah, it was really, really intense. I would think pretty hard before I do it next time. The thing I would say, though, is that a lot of people are buying my stuff because of the podcasts and the videos. It's a bit weird if I don't do them. So I talked to Bumble about this. Bumble doesn't do them because everyone hates doing them, right? Except for the people who do them professionally. Everyone else hates doing them. And I was like, and Bumble's like, yeah, I get a friend to do it and he's an actor and he's very good and whatever. And I'm like, if I buy a Bumble book, I actually want Bumble to speak to me, right? Because of Bumble's voice. And I'm not on Bumble's level, although I did do a voiceover for ad recently, but I'm not on Bumble's level. But I think that my voice is related to my writing now. And it's always forever linked to that. So yeah, it was interesting. I'm not going to rush to do it again, but I probably will do my next one. And then let's see how we go after that. MF Jim says, after Zimbabwe's win last week, should England be worried about the warm-up test against the mate? Well, someone else has already asked that. It's the bowling attack, MF Jim. It is a bowling attack. I've been saying this for ages. Zimbabwe fans were really, really negative on this team. And I'm like, guys, you've got a good bowling attack. That's like 60% of the battle. Their batting's not quite as good. Neil says, Washington Sundar slightly remodeled his action ahead of his return to the test side in November. Apparently he worked with S. Sriram and now gets more overspin. What have you made of it compared to what he did before? I hadn't noticed that. S. Sriram is a brilliant coach, and I hope he gets more and more work. I think he's a really, really smart guy. And I was lucky enough to sit down and have an hour with him one day. And it was just one of those people that you just like, oh, this guy knows what he's talking about. That's a good person to talk to. I think if you're a tall spinner, it's not even that you want to rework your action to have more overspin. I think you want to be able to get overspin when you need it, right? I think that was Ashwin's big thing. Ashwin kind of learned that on his own. On flat wickets, especially outside of Asia, overspin is a really important thing. But if you're tall, it's just an extra weapon, right? Bloody says, there's a famous quote by W.G. Grace about always electing to bat first if you win the toss. Why did he believe that back then? The pitches were uncovered and liquid manure was used. Wouldn't it have made sense to bowl first quite a lot back then? And anything always bat, the bat first approach makes more sense today. Do you know what? I've never looked at the 1800s and how often they did it. It's always been the thought that runs on the board are very important in cricket. But also, perhaps in the uncovered wicket days, if you bat first on that pitch, are you not batting on it when it's at its absolute best in those days before the muck spreaders come in the 1900s, and that changes things a little bit? So I don't know, Bloody, to answer your question, but he was pretty clever at cricket, so maybe he was right. How many hours do batters and bowlers practice in a week before a test match and a series and in the IPL? Look, that's very different. That is different for player, for bowlers especially. Workload will come in. Most teams do about a 3-hour practice, so they split the practices up between what, 10 and 1 and 1 and 4, I think, is usually test matches. And in if you're playing in a tournament or a league, you have either the afternoon session or the evening session quite often for your practices. They're usually around 3 hours long. A top batter will probably do main nets and then do throwdown. So they're probably doing about an hour and a half a day of batting. You do get the sort of Nicholas Pooran, Steve Smith, I'm trying to think of who else, those sort of gym net rats who might do 2.5 hours, right? And there are some players who do even more than that. It's actually fairly rare. And if you're not a star, it's hard to get enough people to throw the balls to you, and there's not always enough nets and all that sort of stuff. Bowlers, it's just a workload thing. So you won't get many bowlers bowling more than about 4 to 6 overs in a session unless there's a reason for them to do that. And then if it's a test match, you might get 2 heavy days out from the game. So let's say day -3, -2, you probably get a decent amount of practice in. And then -1, you might just go through the motions a little bit at that stage. But yeah, fast bowlers don't bowl a lot. Spinners, it depends on if they're working on something and everything else. But most training sessions in cricket are around 3 hours long. And a bowler is probably bowling for about 40 minutes in those. And they might bowl, they might split it up and bowl it in they might bowl a little bit more, but over 2 different cycles. But it depends on what they're looking for, or what they're trying to do. It's so dependent. And different bowlers don't like to bowl a lot in the nets, and other bowlers like to. Satchmo says, how would you compare Hobbs and Grace as batters? They're very similar. If you're looking at the all-time greatest batters and you're forgetting test cricket and you're just looking at all-time great batters, you're looking at probably 2 of the top 5 of all time, up there with Bradman, Sachin, and probably Viv Richards comes in if you bring in all format. So they're very high up on that list. Hobbs is probably the first fully complete batter in that he had all the shots. He was very fast on his feet. He was a decent athlete. Everything was quite polished. I think if you watch footage of Jack Hobbs bat, you will see what looks like test batting today, right? You know, it's a bit more like Bradman. It's a bit more herky jerky at times. He's not going to look like, I don't know, Michael Clark or James Vince or BVS Laxman or something. It's not as smooth as those guys, but all the shots are there and the majority of the technique is there. Whereas if you look at footage of Grace, and we don't have Grace until he's a little bit older, but it's quite clear that Grace is not anywhere near the same level as batter as Hobbs. And how could he be? Because he invented the art, right? So he's at the front end of that, inventing what is modern batting. And Hobbs is at the other end of that. Hobbs is probably at the beginning of the next cycle, which is perfecting batting, right? Which is where Bradman comes in, right? So they're very different from that. But both of them have 2 of the highest ratios of all time for a decade. You know, not quite Bradman level, but like almost Bradman level numbers for, you know, actually, Hobbs is probably only 6 or 7 years, or it might be longer, I can't remember. And Grace is for the first decade of Test cricket. Ali says, is it tough being a non-Indian content creator in a sport whose fan base and global administration is increasingly becoming more Indian in relation to the great cricketer's recent legal letter? Look, I've had legal letters from other cricket boards that are not Indian before. I've had issues with Sri Lankan politicians. I've had issues with very important people in very important countries like England and Pakistan before. So it's tough being a global content creator in a sport like this in general. Fan base is interesting. I think the biggest thing with the fan base is that people who don't know you, I got this Instagram message recently and the guy apologized eventually because he realized he was wrong. But he'd seen one video, like a short clip, and I don't even know what it was about. And he's like, oh, typical white guy, just wants to go back to when England ruled the game and blah, 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 blah. Now, all of you who have followed this know, my God, like I've written a book called Overthrowing Cricket's Empire, right? I've been more critical on how England have run the game than all the people who moan about it online ever have. In detail, step by step, research on these things, right? This isn't like a casual thing for me. But a lot of casual fans who don't know this and see one clip and maybe I said something negative about the BCCI or something, I don't even know what it was. They take it completely out of context. And it's because of, right, generally either my accent, which they think is English, but even if they think I'm Australian, and my skin color. That's the gig, right? Sports writing is that. You're always doing that. Like, I remember, I can't remember who it was, but there was a basketball writer who said that he thought the big pivot to stats in sport actually came from white guys wrote about sport while non-white guys played it. And so it was getting ickier and ickier to judge players based on vibes and everything else. And it's a really interesting one. It's not why I got into stats. I got into stats because I thought that was a better way of telling stories in T20 cricket specifically. But I can understand his point as well. Like, if you've got a bunch of university educated white guys who are talking about, you know, high school people who are playing basketball, you know, from a completely different world, there is a culture clash there. And it is probably a bit icky at times. But that's the gig. That's sports writing, right? That's just what it is. And if it wasn't India, it would be Pakistan. And if it wasn't Pakistan, it would be Bangladesh. And if it wasn't Bangladesh, it would be West Indies. Some of the most vicious stuff I've ever received has been from the West Indies. Some of the most vicious stuff I've ever received has been from Australia. I would say the most vicious attacks I ever get, like in emails, like really, really dark, terrible things, generally have come from Australia or the West Indies. So that's the gig. You write about sport. People get really upset. They don't put anything in context. We try and put everything in context, but they've only seen a 1 minute clip. Oh, why is that not working? Adityan says, what are the logistic stuff that you need to handle before the release of The Arts of Batting? This book, The Arts of Batting. Do you like handling logistics? For some reason, I'm guessing the answer is no, but you never know. There are writers who like it. What are the logistics? So we had to do tons of research. So that's where we started, right? So that was really labor intensive. Then there's the writing. Writing I love. Research I enjoyed, but I got too deep into it. And it almost derailed the book at a certain point. The writing bits, once I started writing it, I loved it. I love writing about this topic. It was so enjoyable. It was awesome. The editing bit, this is the first time I've ever worked with a great crew. Caroline, who I met the other night, and people who work with Caroline, we have Nilesh, we obviously Cheyenne as a researcher, Abhishek was a little bit involved as well. All these different people reading it. That is frustrating because it's just literally people telling you you're wrong about things. And there's no, even though you need those people, there's no way not to feel that way. But it also allows you to reshape the chapters and little bits and things. And you know, we still didn't improve everything I wanted to improve in the book, but you really got it really clear. Then you've got the sort of fine sub-editing and you know, fact-checking at the end. That is really strenuous. And with a company like Bloomsbury that's so big and had so many different people coming on board, like I didn't have relationships with their people. And like I remember one guy was like really upset that I called Fred Truman the first modern bowler because he's like, what about Larwood? And I can't even talk to this guy. I'm never going to meet him. And it's just like comments on the side of the thing. And you're trying to explain to him that Larwood isn't really the fully developed bowler that Truman is. Truman is the first guy with all the tools that you need as a fast bowler. But, you know, so I kind of have that conversation with this dude, right? And then you get to the sort of the PR stuff. I don't like asking my friends for things. Like, if you have a look, who've we got? So the two guys on the front cover are Zoltzman and Bumble, right? Both people I've had podcasts with. You know, on the back, we've got Wright Thompson, another close friend of mine. Harsha, who I've known for, you know, what, 10, 15 years now. You know, people I've worked with before, people I have relationships with before. I could have asked other famous people to do it, but I felt uncomfortable even asking them to do it. And then people don't get back to you and you feel like a dick for having to follow up. So I didn't like that. That was the bit I hated the most, was sending a book to people who were famous, who were friends of mine, and asking them to say something nice about me. I hated that so much. And some people were absolutely great at it. And other people were like, can you write this? I'm like, I can't write, you know. But, you know, people like Damien Fleming and Mark Butcher, they came up really, really big. All the quotes that we got were just phenomenal on the book. I hated that. I'm currently hate the bit where I have to like tap up all my friends and try and get them to write about it, to talk about it, you know, to include it and stuff. Like it's not how I like to do things. I really like promoting my stuff and marketing my stuff, but I kind of don't like it when I have to get other people to help. And now I'm in the bit of where we go next. Like we've done so much promotion for the book. We've got a bunch of stuff to come out now. It's frustrating and everything. But this is the first time. This is what, my sixth book, I think. This is the first time I feel like I've ever done it properly. And I'm learning a lot. And I'm really, really proud of the book. Like I really like the book. And it's been read by about 30 or 40 people now. And so many positive comments have come back. I've never had a project where this has happened, probably since Death of a Gentleman. So, but yeah, look. it's getting a book out is hard, and it's getting more and more hard. In the old days, I would release a book, and like in 2015, I released Test Cricket, and I just had to put up a Twitter link like once a week, and we sold copies off the back of that. Right? If I put a link up now, no one, that tweet will get buried. It'll be shadow banned by Elon Musk for putting a link up. It's so hard now to get people to see the thing that you're doing. So, yeah. From Virat Kohli's MCG 6 against Pakistan to Bumrah's stump-destroying Yorker to Ollie Pope, incredible things happen on the cricket ground. We also get iconic lines off it, like Siraj saying, "I only believe in Jassie Bhai." There are so many incredible moments that cricket fans just never forget. And now you can wear them on your chest. Free Hit Gear has launched a line of amazing t-shirts and hoodie designs. Passionate fans in India can order through their website, freehitgear.com, while fans abroad can use Free Hit Gear on the Etsy store to have items delivered to them. Order now with the code GOODAREAS, or one word, to get a limited time 15% discount, and you can wear a t-shirt like this one right here. PJ says, if you had to rename your Patreon tiers after international cricketers, who would they be? Well, okay, James Hopes would be the first tier. Second tier would be John Scholes. Third tier would be Bryce McGain. The fourth tier would be Venkatapati Raju. The fifth tier would be, I think we've got five tiers. The fifth tier would be Sobers, Sehwag or Gilchrist, I think. Completely off the top of my head. I'm not sure there's any internal logic to what I just said out loud. Sports podcasts really are just dudes naming people's names. MF Jim says, after the BCCI stopped the great cricketer from using any Getty image pictures, the use of the IPL and of official names. Oh, yeah, so we've already talked about it. Why are sports leagues so protective over seemingly meaningless rights when it is ultimately promoting the game? A side note, isn't editorial use still commercial? Yeah, that one I don't get. I really have trouble with editorial use, and I've got in trouble with that, not on my YouTube page, but in previous lives, because I'm like, well, this is editorial. This is an editorial product. Oh, but you're trying to sell it. I'm like, well, what are they not trying to sell newspapers? Like you can use that image on a news broadcast. Isn't a news broadcast there to make money too? I have real problems with the editorial and commercial. In fact, I was reading up on it the other day because of this. But look, I think they think at the moment everyone wants a piece of the IPL, and everyone's making a piece of the IPL, making money off the IPL, and they want a piece of everyone else's pieces. The issue with that is, like, it's not going to really stop the great cricketer doing from what they're doing. And I would assume the great cricketer can't afford to buy their data package. So I don't really see how that helps. But you might also have some of the people who've bought the rights packages or whatever these name sponsor packages or whatever they're calling them are. Who are saying, well, we've paid for it. Why are the great cricket going to get away with it? I don't know. But yeah, it's not how I would run sport, but I don't run sport. West Indies cut down their first class competition to 5 games to save costs, and they announced they are spending $1 million on the T20 breakout tournament. New Zealand are investing in MLC teams, both boards giving their main reasons as developing the next generation of white ball talent. While these are great initiatives, isn't this just wishful thinking though? All you're doing is spending a little bit of money that you have on developing free talent for franchise billionaires and the Saudis. Yes, but you're still going to have World Cups and maybe in the West Indies case, not the case, but Olympics and everything else. Sporting bodies around the world develop footballers, and most of their footballers go and play overseas in other leagues, right? Like the idea is you hope to come back and qualify for a World Cup or win a World Cup or win a Euros or qualify for a Euros or whatever that may be. You know, that's what you're trying to do, isn't it? So cricket is just getting to the position that all the other sports have been in before, I would say, PJ. Is that question twice or am I clicking the wrong thing? Now I don't know what I'm doing. Ah, there we go. Emron says, I've been watching a lot of videos about the Dr. Joan Vickers research regarding the quiet eye in various sports. Mike McKelvey has done a great video on it as well. Has there been much research on this in cricket? I've had some big improvements in my pool game myself by training my quiet eye. I don't know too much about the quiet eye. Someone sent me an email about it a couple of years ago. It's the one where you do that. Look, we know Dr. Sherelle Calder has done heaps of stuff on that. I don't think she calls it the quiet eye, but I would assume it's the exact same thing. I talk a lot about it in the book as well. There's a chapter on eyesight and eyes and how they work. I don't think as athletes, athletes always understand how their eyes work, as in that you need to train your eyes, that you need to know what you're looking at. And most often when form goes wrong, I think the first thing anyone should check is not the eyesight, But what is the batter looking at the moment? I think that's where form goes wrong a lot. But yeah, that's all I know, Imran. Sorry. Manon says, what are some specific gym exercises that bowlers or batters do that other athletes out of cricket don't? I don't think there's anything. I mean, the vast majority of stuff that is done in cricket is core, right? And core is pretty generic. Cricketers have been talking about core since the late 70s. There was that period, I think, when Cricket Australia got a little bit obsessed with upper body strength, and that probably didn't pan out as much. I know that when Gale had a form dip at one stage, he went back to just trying to find his core again and strengthen his core. So I would say most athletes have to have a strong core. Like, not every sport needs to focus on it as much as cricket, but I would say that's pretty normal. Prashant says, I love your unbiased analysis. Thanks on cricket. Thank you very much. My question is related to how can analysts work towards not letting their bias or their idea of playing a format dictate their analysis? Is it easy to cherry pick data points to prove your preconceived notions, but how do you work to consistently overcome them in cricket analytics? I don't know if I have a great answer for this, because neurodiversity probably plays a part in this for me. You know, I don't know all the different neurodivergent things I have. I don't actually have time to be tested for them all, really, but I think that probably plays a part in that I am much more interested in finding or getting as close to the perceived truth. I'll tell you a conversation we had with Wright Thompson. Me and Wright were talking about feature writing, and Wright Thompson feels that when he has finished a feature, what he has written is the truth, right? Now, obviously, years later, things will change and everything else. That's one thing I don't think I could ever do the way that Wright Thompson did. I finished off and I always felt this is as close as I can get to the truth. Now, we most might have interviewed 40 people, and I think he's a better investigative journalist than I am, but I've got pretty good skills with that as well. But I can never feel sure. And I think Wright Thompson does. And it's probably one of the reasons he's the best sports writer in the world, right? And so for me, I feel like I'm always searching for the truth. That doesn't, so if something comes up and it completely changes my notion, so people will often say, what's something that you had one idea on and then you change your mind to? It's like, that's everything. I'm constantly doing that. I'm constantly searching for the thing that I think is true, that is right. And that's just how I'm wired. So it's just different. And I don't know if I can help anyone else be like that. I remember, and I think I've told this story before, and it's weird because my mum isn't really like this anymore, but for whatever reason, she really trained me this way. I came into my mum and I made some joke about how communism was shit. And she said, have you studied communism? And I went, you know, I just made it. She said, well, how do you know? And I think I've lived my whole life with that. Sometimes I'll come in with a preconceived idea and it'll be wrong. Very rarely do I have the same preconceived idea when I finish studying it. And that's what I probably do. I just hop from topic to topic. Sam Deep says, you mentioned some batsmen trying to handle the ball with sweat-drenched gloves to remove the shine in a Sunday stream. In Sunday stream. Yeah, we did that on the Cricket 8 one. More such wily things, not necessarily batsmen related. Oh, there's heaps of them, man. You know, there's obviously which hand the batter is holding the ball in, the bat in at the non-striker's end to let someone know. There is there is the wicketkeeper who turns behind to make it look like they've missed the ball. That's been legislated out of the game, but that was a common thing when I played club cricket. Wicketkeepers would always be pretending they fumbled the ball and had missed the ball. Trying to think of some of the others. You know, batters pulling away at the last minute, pretending something was in their eye against a fast bowler who's in the fourth or fifth over of their spell. Javed Mian Dad not standing in the same place on the crease over and over again. The sort of the whole Mark Watt thing of using the crease, whether you're going back or even from, you know, different angles. You know, the Shane Warne thing of the ball before he bowled around the wicket, he bowled really wide of the crease. So he wanted the maximum distance between the two. There's, you know, Mike Brearley putting the helmets at cover with a gap at cover and trying to get Alan Lamb to hit through cover. There's so many crazy little things that cricketers do to one up each other. I mean, Stuart Broad and the bail with Marnus. What's he trying to do there? Just get him out of his bubble. Simple as that. Ali says, since PSL has a complicated draft system, which has arguably led to some parity, would you still advocate for free agency even in PSL, which can lead to lopsidedness in a 16 league and subsequently predictability and boringness? Yeah, I don't know if I want free agency with only six teams. It feels a little bit messy. I think eight is probably the minimum. I'm not a huge fan of the draft in the PSL, but I understand your general point. I still think, though, at a certain point, that a player who's 28 years old, who has been playing for 8 years and has played 60 games, deserves to pick where they want to go next rather than just being forced in different directions. And I know free agency can be a little bit, there are a lot of people who follow American sports who think free agency is when American sports went down the drain. But I just think that these are professionals and they deserve to, they have then made the decision, they have had the career that allows them to make the decisions that they should want to make. Akash says, what is the rationale behind playing Tristan Stubbs at six? He is better than a power hitter. And why play so many anchors in Faf, KL, and Karan Nair? I don't know if Faf is an anchor, and I don't know if Karan Nair is playing as an anchor, but I understand your point. I think they've just come in with the idea that they want someone to control the back end of their innings for them, and Stubbs is very well suited to that. I'd have to have a look at his record coming in earlier against Ben. Also, I think Stubbs is a much better player than he was a year ago. It's possible that the team has still got that mindset of him of a year back. He's at number three in Test cricket now, right? Like, I wasn't sure what the future of Stubbs was. And I've gone from being a little bit, I like him and he's obviously talented, but I'm not sure how this is going to work, to being like, oh my God, how good's Tristan Stubbs? Rob says, what do you think about making Test matches 4 days with the fifth day being a reserve day for the weather or poor light? I don't actually think that helps all that much, Rob. You still have to spend a lot of money on hiring people and have the ground free and have flights and everything. I actually don't think that saves you money. I think you either make it 4 day or you make it 5 day. Ankush says, how long will it be before we see an under 19, under 23 IPL? They could be second tier and maybe some players earn call ups to the senior team due to an injury. I would probably push for if I was an owner and I had a lot of money. So if I was the Ambanis, right? Or Goenka, or I know one of the, you know, not if I'm Rajasthan, I probably don't want this. But if I'm one of the other ones where I have lots of money and I'm a decision maker, I would want a second tier competition running during the IPL. That's what I want. I want minors and majors like basketball, like baseball. That's what I really want. So that I've got a fast bowler that I know in the back end of the season I want to play, but I can't actually fit him into the front end of the season. I want him actually playing some games in the minor league at the moment. Overseas players, local players and everything. I'm not as worried about junior stuff. They did have the baby bash in Australia, which was a good thing. I think you do that separately at a different time in the year, which I also think they should do. And I do agree, Ankush, we'll have that within the next 5 to 10 years. But what I would want, if I'm a general manager and I'm working with a team, is I want the SMAT being played now. It doesn't have to be called the SMAT, but that's what I want. I'm not worried about it being massively broadcast or anything else. It can be played during the day, whatever. But I want my players who are not playing to be able to go off. You look at minor league baseball. You look at the G League in basketball. You just want your players to get some game time sometimes. Sandeep says, thoughts on 4-year home and away, full round robin, World Test Championship system that's been in the news recently. Yeah, it's another way of doing it. I don't have a problem with the 2-year one. If they, but 4-year, the Ashes and World Cups have been on 4-year cycles. The Olympics are on 4-year cycles. I don't mind that. I don't think but if we do that, can we have it, do it properly and also have semifinals, right? And, I think there's more flexibility that we can do going ahead. How would you describe Carroll's innings versus RCB, 41 off 39? The thing with Carroll is, and he's been playing really good this year. So I don't, a lot of this is from years gone back. But the thing with Carroll is I just don't think it takes him a lot to go back into that mode. And so I think he does it quite often too early and too dramatically, and it can cause issues. That's the issue with him. It's not that he occasionally plays defensively or anchorly, because there are times when you should do that. The issue with him is I just think it's too easy to push him into that mode. And I think Virat has an issue with that as well. They just don't believe in other batters, right? I wrote something that Cricket Australia didn't really like. Actually, it might have been in a podcast or an article. I can't remember now. But I said that Australia just had to really encourage Virat and KL to go down that route by taking early wickets and then bowling the way they did. And I think the Australian team took that as, they were going to do it anyway and we had no part of it. That's not the way I meant it. What I meant is, you almost want to manufacture a system, which is what the Australian team did in that situation, to put themselves into a position to allow those players to do that. You need to know your opposition. That's not how Sky would have played that, 23 World Cup final, right? Like, that's not how Abhishek Sharma would have done it. So sometimes, you know, knowing that. And I think with Carol, he just, it doesn't take much to kind of push him back and make him do that. So yeah, very, very different from that perspective. All right. The game's starting in a minute, but I've got a couple of super chats. So let's go through them. Andy says, what's Brevis's ceiling as a white ball batter? Is he ready to start for South Africa? Higher peak, Jordan or LeBron? Jordan had a higher peak than LeBron. What's Brevis's ceiling as a white ball batter? I'm in a similar place now with Brevis. In fact, I've been a Brevis doubter for a little while. Longer than I certainly, and maybe as long as I had been with Stubbs. I don't know what the finished article with Brevis is at the moment. I don't know how to visualize that. I don't know if he's a slightly more aggressive Aiden Markram or if he's AB de Villiers with a mix of Heinrich Klaassen. I don't know. So I suppose that's his ceiling and his floor is a more aggressive version of Aiden Markram, I suppose. What do you think about Vaibhav as a parent? Yeah, I've talked about this. Me and Robbie did a podcast about it, Gargis. So it's worth going and finding it, the Kim Apa, not the last one, the episode before that. I do feel uncomfortable as a parent watching this. And I've always felt uncomfortable with women's tennis players as well. It's hard because fans want young players and it's really exciting and it's a great story and I absolutely love all of that side of it. But, you know, I have a 12-year-old who's a pretty smart kid and I don't know how he would handle this. And maybe the 14-year-olds, and he's not, let's say he's not 14, let's say 16, 17, whatever he might actually be. It doesn't really matter. Because his talent is ready for this level, does that mean everything else is ready for this level, right? And is there anyone making a decision in the best interest of him as a human being? Or are we all making best decisions on him as a cricketer? And that's always my worry. I've said this before, and this is, I said it well before Vaibhav, and I've said it with older players as well. I don't think we look after the welfare of cricketers that are coming through the system. We just get really excited that there's a talent there, and we put a lot of pressure on them. And I would like the system to be in place to be better for that. I love watching him bat. I really hope he gets through it. But I have seen a lot of people break through as a teenager and be broken in their 20s, right? I don't want that to happen to anyone. Subway says, calling the fans Nazis on the Great Cricketer podcast isn't helpful. I have absolutely no idea what you're talking about, Subway Surfer. I'm assuming you mean Great Cricketer podcast. I can't help you there. I don't listen to Great Cricketer podcast. Wouldn't that be something that you should be talking to them about? Arant says, why does Wasim Akram's top peer rating as a GOAT pacer? Oh, not fully match his performance, ranking him top 15 by Marshall McGrath, despite his greatness. Yeah, I think the interesting thing with Wasim Akram for me is that Imran Khan's record is better. And that doesn't make sense to me. I always thought with Wasim Akram, and I've said this before, I don't know if he had a great length that you just couldn't play him off. Pollock, Hadley, McGrath, Marshall. Most bowlers have a great length that you cannot play them off, right? There's nothing you can do. They just continue to trap you. And I always felt watching Wasim that he would bowl a couple of full ones, a couple of short ones, a couple on a good length, maybe occasionally back of a length, although that wasn't always his thing. And it's the same with Waka. And I just wondered if they didn't have that, and that eventually just held them back, slowed them down a little bit. Whereas if you're, you know, Wasim Akram is a much more well-rounded, useful bowler than Joel Garner. But it doesn't matter because no one could hit Joel Garner, right? So Joel Garner is maybe better at one single skill and Wasim Akram might be better at everything else, but you might still pick Joel Garner over Wasim Akram just because of that. I hope that answers it correctly. This is my memory as someone who watched cricket in the 90s. I just felt like you watch Kirtley and McGrath, who were on a similar level talent-wise to Akram, they were just so repeatable and there was nothing you could do to get them off their game. Whereas with Wasim, I just never felt that. Akash says, recently I watched the 1980s Bodyline show. It's like a mini-series, isn't it? Like a small series, 3 or 4 episodes. Lots of drama on and off the field, boardrooms to power corridors. Is there any other series you think would make for a similar dramatic series which had an impact beyond the boundary? 2007-08 India-Australia would be a fantastic one to do. I'm not sure you could do a great series on it because I don't think it was written enough, but the first try series in Test cricket would be quite interesting because it's what we got the ICC out of, and the Australian team, basically half the team went on strike. So those two instantly come to mind. I suppose 2005 Ashes is a really interesting one. 2001 Australia, India. I'm trying to think of another one that has like a political intrigue as well. There must be a great India-Pakistan series I can't think of off the top of my head. I almost want the one in, is it 86, 87, just because of the last test match, but I'm trying to think of the rest of the series. Is there another interesting one, India-Pakistan in the early 80s? But there must be. I must be missing something obvious with India-Pakistan. I suppose Pakistan-Sri Lanka with the terrorist bombing would be another one. One I would actually like to recreate is West Indies losing to New Zealand. I think that would be another fascinating one, Akash, off the top of my head. Jack says, will the bowlers of the 70s, 80s have fewer or more wickets if DRS had existed back then, or will it be they be roughly the same? I think there would be some bowlers who would have fewer, some bowlers who would have more, but I think they would have adapted to that. I think if Richard Hadlee bowls today, he'd bowl the wobble ball, not outswing, and he'd aim the ball at the stumps a lot more. I don't know how you would play Malcolm Marshall if he had the wobble ball. I don't know how you would survive him. Bisham Baydy, I've said this before, you look at some of the old spinners, they didn't always attack the stumps all the time. Bisham Baydy could have hit the stumps every single ball if he wanted to. So there's a bowler that certainly would. And Abdul Qadir, oh my God, how many more LBWs would Bisham Baydy and Abdul Qadir have got if they just had DRS? But they'd be different kinds of bowlers. And there would be some bowlers from that period. I'm trying to think of someone. Terry Alderman. Terry Alderman is probably much more suited to a DRS era than he is to a non-DRS era. Whereas is Malcolm, is Joel Garner less favored by that? Just going off the top of my head, trying to think of some of the great older bowlers. But the thing is that they would have developed and they would have worked it out. Like Garner still would have been great, but would he have been great in a slightly different way? I don't know. The very best players generally adapt in their peaks. And so if they had to have dealt with it, I think they would have dealt with it pretty fine. That's it for me. IPL game has started. I have other things to do, all these sorts of things. Thank you to everyone for their support with the super chats and all the other chats as well in the group today. We will be back very soon. I think me and Bayram want to do something on Vaibhav. We've just done a big Who is the Greatest Test Batter of All Time knockout podcast, which is now two podcasts. It went for like 2.5 hours. That was good fun to do. We've got a heap of content coming up in the next little while as well. Something on Gujarat. I've got a couple of things on sort of trends within T20 cricket that we could see in the IPL at the moment. Plenty of other things to come. Go to goodareas.co, do all these things, and we will see you again very, very soon for more of this sort of stuff here on Good Areas. Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bayram Kazi and Estelle Vasudevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, oh, you are going to need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up incredible clips from your podcasts and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.